The Douglas Coleman Show is made possible with support from Seth David Radwell, a recent guest on the program and author of American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation, released this past July. As Publishers Weekly writes in its recent glowing book life review of American Schism, business executive Radwell's epic debut examines the historical influences that have led to what he sees as the collapse of politics in the United States. Seth Radwell makes the case that the current chasm between the American right and left can be traced back to the 18th century's Age of Enlightenment and the basic tenets of liberty, equality, and reason. American Schism provides a historical perspective that can help us fight today's unreason with reason and bridge current day divides. American Schism by Seth David Radwell is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. For more information, go to AmericanSchismBook.com.
It's time for the Douglas Coleman Show. Mr. Smooth and Savvy is joined by guests from all walks of life, from the entertainment industry to authors to political and social commentators, the famous and not so famous, the controversial and the light and fluffy. We have it all. Now, here's Douglas Coleman.
Okay, please welcome back to the Douglas Coleman Show, Austin Davis. Hey, Austin, welcome back.
Hello, my friend. Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to hear your voice, man.
Oh, my pleasure. Always nice to have you on. I always enjoy our conversations.
Yeah, me as well. I think, how many times have I been on your show now? Is it three times? Something like that?
Yeah, I just looked it up. In fact, you were on twice before, but this is, depending on how long we go, this may be a standalone. Because the last couple of times, you know, we had you on is with someone else because the interview was only 15 or 20 minutes long or something.
Right. So. Yeah, I think the first time was with Ari, and then the second time, I believe Loverboy, that was the musician's name. Very cool people, yeah.
Oh, Loverboy, yeah, from Brazil. Yeah, he was a character. He was something else. I liked his videos. I thought his videos were really well done.
Yeah, I checked out the page after hearing our show together, and we follow each other now, I think. Yeah, or I follow him.
Yeah, he was cool. I mean, there was so much going on in his videos. It just reminded me of, like, David Bowie and just all kinds of stuff with the makeup and the kind of androgyny and the whole thing going on. Yeah, it was great. I really liked it. So what have you been up to? Are you still working with the homeless? I see pictures on your Instagram once in a while that you're still out on the streets.
So still running AZ Hugs for the Houseless. We have an event every Sunday where in Tempe, which is where I go to school at ASU. But, you know, throughout the week, still doing my thing, man. I give everyone I meet my number. So I just answer calls, go around, hang out with the homies, you know, bring people special requests and doing the same old thing, man. It's what I love to do.
I watched a news blip yesterday that they happen to be talking about the homeless, specifically in San Francisco, where it's a huge problem. And, you know, there were different approaches. There were different people. They had a panel that was kind of a good mix of people with different opinions. I guess in San Francisco now, they've started a program where they're trying to encourage people to actually take homeless people into their homes. Okay.
Wow.
And while the idea is good, and, you know, I think it's very admirable if somebody would do that, obviously there are risks involved in doing that. And I think a lot of people wouldn't be comfortable having a strange person in their house. So they had, you know, different people debating on, you know, what the likelihood of success this program was going to be. And apparently there are some 35,000 homeless people in San Francisco on the streets.
Wow.
And this program that they started has taken 60 off the street. So, I mean, 60 out of 35,000, that's kind of a drop in the bucket, I think.
Yeah, you know, the way I look at it, though, I haven't heard of that program per se, but, you know, every person that we can get housed and every person that we can get off the streets and into the next chapter of life, that's a huge win, you know, because the cycle of homelessness is so complex. It's super complicated, you know. And when we can break that for just one person, you know, that's one life that you've saved, you know, and I think that's a huge deal, you know. For me, you know, as I've been doing this work for about three-ish years, I think I've learned a lot about the complexities of homelessness, but what I've found, and this is, you know, the heart of our program of AZ Hugs, is, you know, helping one person one situation at a time, you know, whatever that one person needs in the moment. Maybe it's someone to listen to, maybe it's a drive to rehab, you know, maybe it's getting connected to the right resources. Maybe yesterday, you know, we brought someone to go get their ID because they just got a job, you know, it's those little things. And I think that taking that one-on-one approach is the key to ending homelessness. It's just, I think it's a really complicated issue, and I think it's a really long process for a lot of people.
Well, I agree. And there's also a lot of different reasons why people become homeless.
Oh, yeah.
And I think addressing that is a good place to start as well. One of the things that they said on this panel was they were trying to determine how many of these people were suffering from mental illness and how many were suffering from addiction and how many people were just kind of down on their luck, like they lost their job, they were working paycheck to paycheck, the landlord raised the rent too much, they got kicked out or whatever. So all of these different things, in your travels through this, in your experience, what have you seen is there a number one reason that people are homeless?
No, I mean, I think that for a lot of people, it's, you know, a really bad thing happened and that sent them to the streets. And that's what I've seen for the majority of folks is you lose your job, you get a high medical bill, someone dies, and you suddenly become homeless. And then there's a lot of complexities about what happens next. All the data shows that the more time that you spend on the streets, the likelihood that you try a drug or get addicted to something, you know, doubles and triples and times 1,000 or whatever, you know, just because it's so readily available. And from what I've seen, loneliness is the silent killer of those experiencing homelessness, you know, because in a society that doesn't feel like those experiencing homelessness have value or worth, you know, that really gets to a person, you know. And I often sit with people on the side of street corners while they fly their signs, you know, and we just talk and chat, because people will say that flying a sign like that is like a full-time job, you know. You have to take breaks because there are so many people who will drive up and maybe take a video of you or a picture or laugh at you, or there are even some people who like throw change or throw things at those experiencing homelessness because they just don't respect them, you know. And that's hugely painful, you know. So, you know, with my project, we just want to show people that they're valued and respected and loved, you know, and this doesn't have to be the last phase of their life for them, you know. But I think that mental illness contributes heavily, and I suffer from OCD and depression, and I have Tourette's syndrome, and I think that that's one of the reasons that I really started to connect with a lot of folks, even before I started doing, you know, running this program when I was younger. You know, when I was in my adolescence, teenage years, I used to just go out to the streets and I would just talk to people. I wouldn't bring anything out, you know. Maybe I was just going home from school and I saw someone flying a sign. I'd go over and say, "Hey, I'm Austin. How's it going, man?" And we just started talking and chatting. And I think that I, you know, kind of connected with a lot of people's mental health issues, I guess, just because I was experiencing something similar to that degree. And then, you know, I just became friends with a lot of folks and it grew. And Arizona Jews for Justice is the father program of this project, and they really taught me how to be a strong community leader and, you know, bring people together for one common goal. So I'm really grateful for that. But, you know, to circle back to your original question, yeah, you know, I think that unforeseen circumstances are what's sending a lot of people to the streets. I mean, especially with the current pandemic, you know, a lot of people are being evicted or losing the job or whatever, you know, and it's a really tough time for a lot of people. I think we were talking last time on your show, I was seeing a lot of people who were telling me they're new to homelessness, you know, and that's still the case. There's a lot of people who I've met kids out on the streets, teens, a lot of elderly people. It affects people from all ages, all demographics.
Did you say Jews for Justice?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have to be Jewish to join?
No, I'm actually not Jewish.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I didn't know if you were Jewish.
The program is Arizona Jews for Justice, and I got an internship with them a couple years ago, And they really just taught me how to organize my community. They're a really cool social justice organization, but no, I'm not Jewish, actually. I guess I consider myself agnostic, but I don't know. The universe and the world is strange, you know, so I'm still figuring all the shit out, my man.
All right. Well, the one issue regarding mental illness, and I know it is a problem with the homeless, and the stories that I've read are that because there are so few facilities, see, back in the old days, they used to just lock everyone up. And they had these enormous mental hospitals that were built, particularly around the turn of the century. And they were these grandiose buildings built by this guy Kirkbride, who I think was the architect. And they're very famous now. A lot of them are abandoned, and they make great sets for horror movies.
Right, yeah.
But there's a whole bunch of them, particularly in Massachusetts, where I come from. There's Danvers State Hospital, Bridgewater State Hospital, and then, you know, a lot of them have been converted into other things or whatever. But back in the old days, they used to just lock everybody up and throw away the key, which was, and then they had these horrible experiments like electroshock therapies and lobotomies, and they were doing all kinds of really barbaric things to these people, right?
Yeah, very inhumane, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. And so back in the early 80s, a lot of the funding for these places got cut off by the government, and the people ended up on the street, okay? Mm. Now, for whatever reason that they were put in the first place, after you spend enough time in one of those places, it can make you crazy.
Mm.
You know, even if you weren't crazy,
yeah, I mean,
quote-unquote.
I imagine the trauma from what people experienced in those hospitals was just devastatingly difficult, you know?
Oh, it's unbelievable, right? So because of the new medications, because of the antipsychotic medications that started coming out in the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of these people got better.
Yeah.
And they were able to sort of rejoin society and be a productive person, right? So they let them out on the streets. But the problem is when they got out on the streets, half the time they'd forget to take their meds.
Mm.
And they'd end up, you know, relapsing back into psychosis. And a lot of times those people just ended up on the streets because they just couldn't handle the whole situation in life. So you had mentioned that, I'm trying to segue this. I know it's long. Forgive me. I'm getting there. So you had mentioned that you had some issues, OCD and Tourette's. Isn't that the one where you swear?
So it can be for some people. I believe Tourette's is, the definition of Tourette's is three or more different tics that you can't control, you know. So sometimes it's a vocal tic for some people, other times it's a body tic. And I believe, you know, when I was being diagnosed with this, they were telling me that it's three different movements or whatever over the course of your life so far, you know. So when I was younger, I had a thing where I'd clear my throat a lot, you know, and that was a compulsive movement that I couldn't control, you know. And I remember right now I have one with my neck, you know, where I can't stop twitching my neck or my hands or my feet or whatever. And one thing that's really difficult about Tourette's, for me at least, is that the movements are painful. They hurt and they're involuntary, so I can't stop them. You know, and they get a lot worse for me personally when I'm stressed and or anxious or whatever, and I'm always stressed or anxious. So
do you take any medications?
I was on Zoloft for my depression and Tourette's for a while, but I also have ADHD, and I found that the Zoloft was kind of sedating me in a way, you know, and I got into a car accident, but that was also because I wasn't really taking care of myself too well, you know, multiple things that go into every part of someone's life, I believe. But right now I'm on Adderall, actually, and it honestly works really well for me. You know, it not only helps me focus, but it, you know, it kind of zones me in. You know, when I'm unmedicated, there's hundreds of thoughts that kind of feel like they're all bouncing around my head, you know, and I can't seem to filter through the ones that I need to, listen to, and the ones that are just bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
But when I take my pill, you know, it kind of feels like, I guess, you know, if your brain's full of water, you know, you're trying to swim through that and find the little lifeboat or whatever, it's like the water's drained out and you're on the beach and you can just think and and exist, you know. And it makes me happier, too, which is nice. I still haven't found the right treatment for my Tourette's yet, but, you know, my mental health and everything, it's a multifaceted issue. You know, there's a lot of different things that are fucked up here, you know. So one thing at a time for me, I guess.
Well, do you find with the OCD that your apartment is incredibly clean?
You know, that's actually a misconception. Yeah. So, I'm actually a pretty messy guy, to be honest, which is funny because, yeah, the popular belief about OCD is that, oh, you know, everything has to be organized.
Right. Clean freak.
Yeah. Yeah. Clean and all that. And, you know, for some people, maybe that is the compulsion, but the heart of OCD are these intrusive thoughts, you know? So if you see someone completing a compulsion to clean their apartment or whatever over and over again, have everything in the exact same line, then, you know, behind that, there are these really scary intrusive thoughts that are telling you if you don't do this compulsion, this really bad thing is going to happen, you know? So for me, I've had, you know, various stages of OCD throughout my life. When I was a kid, this is actually why I think my memory is all fucked up. I have a really bad memory now. When I was a kid, for a really long time, before I would let myself fall asleep, I had to list off every person in my life that I loved, starting with my parents and my siblings and, you know, my close family, going to my best friends and my acquaintances and people at school, all the way down to like teachers and janitors and people at McDonald's and all that. And it had to be in this exact same order. And the fear behind that was I thought, you know, if I didn't do this, the people that I love so deeply would not know that I love them, you know, and that doesn't make sense, of course, but OCD doesn't really make sense. It's just, it's this scary force that's telling you these really terrible things. And it's before, you know, getting treatment, I've been through cognitive behavioral therapy and before, you know, doing that and taking the necessary steps, it's really hard to differentiate a rational thought and an OCD thought. Until you kind of learn what an OCD thought is, you know, why you can't listen to it. Because for me, at least, you know, if you give into the compulsion, it's kind of like a drug, you know, it feels better for a really short second, and then it feels a lot worse. And then you got to do it again. And then it feels a little better for a brief second, you know, and then it feels 10 times worse. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse. So, you know, the key to overcoming OCD is to not listen to the thoughts and to not give in to the compulsions.
That's an interesting analysis, because it's such a fine line there between people's priorities. I mean, I know people that the second that a bill comes in the mail or something, that they have to pay it immediately. Otherwise, they don't sleep, you know, even though it's not due for, you know, 20 days or something. They got to pay it the second it comes in. Otherwise, it gnaws at them, right? And then I know other people that have bills piled up on their desks that are 6 months old, and they're getting final notices and eviction notices and everything, and they're just partying like it's 1999. Yeah, and they don't care at all, right? So there's extremes on both sides, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. The mind is fascinating. I think if I hadn't studied business, I should have studied psychology, because I'm really fascinated by the complexities of the human mind and what we deem as normal.
Right. Is
getting so, it changes. It changes like every generation, it seems to. And then the older you get, I know I'm a good deal older than you, so I can say this with some certainty, that the older you get, the more life you have experienced, it changes your perspectives. It did for me. Yeah. It did for most people. I'm still the same person I was when I was 20, but what I deem important has shifted.
Yeah.
I keep up with the news and social events and current events and political trends and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's like my family and my friends and my dogs and things that are right here in front of me. That's what's important. You know, what's happening in the Ukraine, okay, we can talk about that. But once I turn the computer off, I mean, that's gone. You know, what am I going to do about it, right?
Yeah.
So I don't stay up.
I think that's the heart of life, man, is the love. You know, it's the love that you share with those around you and the love that you give back to your community and all that, you know?
Yeah. So I know this might be a personal question. If you don't want to answer, you don't have to. But do you have a significant other in your life at this point?
Currently, I do not.
Okay.
I've been in a couple long-term relationships over the years, but the last, I'd say, year or so, I've been really, really invested in, you know, my work on the streets and honestly just trying to take care of my mental health. You know, that's been a battle that I've been fighting pretty much throughout the pandemic. That's been pretty difficult for me, but I've dated for sure between then, gone on dates and, you know, had fun and met people. So,
well, the reason I bring that up is because for me, I knew that I was always too self-centered to get involved with anybody else, because the lesson that I've learned is that you really have to give everything of yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously the relationship won't work if you're giving, 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 and your partner is just taking, 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 okay?
Yeah.
On the other hand, it doesn't have to be a 50-50 split. There isn't this need for what I like to call counting the cookies, which came from my college days where you'd go in and your roommate had ate all your cookies and then never puts them back or buys a new bag. So you don't need to say, well, okay, I gave you something. Now it's your turn. I'm waiting for my payback. Yeah. That doesn't work either in a relationship. You know, you give everything you got, but watch the other person and make sure that it's reciprocal. And you can tell. You can absolutely tell. So my point is that I didn't get married till I was 43 years old, okay? And it took me that long to sort of figure it out.
Mm.
Because in my 20s and 30s, forget it. And I was working all the time. So for me, it was just one night stands, you know, until...
Yeah.
I had this epiphany when midlife crisis, I think. I mean, a real bad one. When I was 40 years old, I said, whoa, my grandfather was a grandfather at my age. He got married very young.
Wow.
And I thought, you know what? I didn't have kids at that point. I said, you know what? That's too late. At this point, I don't think I could function without my wife, because it's just, we've become like one.
Yeah.
And it's the most beautiful thing in the world if you can get it. And I have to laugh at like all these Hollywood people, you know, who are just, those relationships, not all, some have worked out very well. But the ones that you see on Instagram all the time, they're all so into themselves. And I can't really see how these relationships can function with two egomaniacs.
Yeah, well, especially in, you know, in the eye of the public or whatever, and when you're catering to an audience or whatever, you know, that all just sounds toxic in a way. You know, fame in a way, you know, sounds that way as well, I believe. But
I agree. I mean, fame is definitely a job.
Yeah.
And it's not everybody can handle it. Particularly when I see these kids like Justin Bieber, for example.
Right.
Now, I'll mention a name. Where he got signed at 15 years old.
Crazy.
Right?
And he was the biggest thing in the world.
For that time, for a few years, he was,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right. When he was probably 15 to 18, something like that.
Yeah.
Biggest thing, you know?
I don't know. He seems to have pulled through, but there were periods there where he certainly was not behaving in a way that was a terribly positive influence, a positive role model for people. And I think obviously he struggled with that a lot, because you don't have the emotional maturity at 15.
I know. I mean, even now, I just turned 22 2 days ago, you know, and my brain's not fully developed yet, you know.
You're sort of like my German Shepherd. You know, German Shepherds, the first year they grow to their massive size. But one of the reasons that the police and the army and they use those dogs is because their brain development is slow, not slow in, you know, the sense of, no, I don't mean stunted, okay? Their brain is slow to develop. In other words, their mental maturity doesn't come till like the third year, okay? Where other dog breeds, the body and the brain are in sync, and they're fully mature at 1 year. But with German Shepherds, the body gets huge, but they're still, their emotional maturity is still puppy for a couple of years, so they can be trained to do anything, and you've got time to train them. And I saw this with mine, because mine's like four now, and for the first few years, I mean, it was this massive puppy. He still would jump all over people. He would still he would still pee uncontrollably when he got excited.
But he's huge, yeah.
And he's huge, right? So he's a little intimidating, right? But now he's like calmed down. I can leave him outside and he'll just sit there with this aloof look on his face, you know, in the driveway or something like that. And he has calmed way down, right? But he still remembers all the things that he's been taught. So you're I think maybe part German Shepherd. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, you know, hey, that's a compliment to me. I'm a big dog guy myself. So, hey, yeah, I mean, I read somewhere that, you know, your brain's most likely not fully developed until the age of 25, you know, and that means I still got a couple years to go before this thing hardens or whatever. Or I don't know what happens up there.
Well, but I
just think it's interesting how, you know, the experiences that we have in our adolescence or, you know, even teenage years, college years, whatever, you know, they form our perception of the world going forward. If your brain's not fully developed, you know, how does that affect the progression of growth up there? I don't know, you know.
I think everybody's different. Yeah. And I think that life experience plays a large part of it. I think nurture is as, if not more important than DNA in terms of mental growth. Because I've talked to people who have had just these horrific childhoods. I mean, sexually abused when they were little kids and alcoholic parents and, you know what I mean? Just the most nightmarish scenario you could think of, living in poverty as well. And they grew up to do great things with their life.
And that's impressive as hell.
Yeah. You know, on the other hand, amazing. On the other hand, I've known people that have grown up in a wealthy family, had everything they ever wanted, and they grew up to be spoiled assholes.
Right.
So it's all and everything in between.
Yeah, you know, I think it takes a lot of work to grow in the ways that you want to. You know, sometimes making these life changes and decisions is really difficult, you know, but I think sometimes it's hard to think about the long-term effects of making positive change in your life, because there might not be an immediate change or whatever. But and I think that's what's difficult at times. But you just got to look towards the future and know that what you're doing is right, you know, and try to do the best you can every day.
Well, also, I think role models are really important for people. And I don't think it's exclusive to children. There's people now, I mean, I'm 60 years old this year, and there are people now that I still look up to like a father figure, okay? Mm. Who I, you know, really admire. So I think that goes all through your life. You know, and when you're a kid, you admire hopefully your parents or a teacher or a coach or somebody in your life. As you get older, it might be college professors. It might be somebody you work with.
Right.
You know, and it goes on and on. So I think that that's so important. I don't think that people should do it alone. I really don't think we should take on the whole world all by ourselves, because it's too daunting. You need a partner or somebody, I think.
You need a partner, a team, a family,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, something.
Whatever that means to you, you know. And I think that that's why making connections in whatever way we can are so vital. That's why the heart of my project on the streets is, you know, making people feel loved and like they have a friend that they can call, or like they have a family. You know, our motto for our Sunday event is Sundays are for the family. That's what we say, you know. And for a lot of people experiencing homelessness, maybe they don't have the conventional family unit that a lot of us do, you know.
That's
so
true.
You build a family, you know, you create a family, and that means the world to a lot of people. And I know for me, my role models are my parents. You know, they're just incredible people, and I'm really blessed to have them help me, you know, guide me through this life.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to shift a little bit, but the segue I want to use is that picture that you posted on Instagram where you're sitting there with words written all over your body. Were you having a bad day, or was that a good day?
Yeah, so that's actually a cool story. Yeah. So all the words that were written on my body in that black and white photo are titles from Lotus and the Apocalypse, which is my book coming out on March 1st. So each poem in the book is titled Lotus and blank. So, you know, for example, one of the poems is Lotus and Depression, and one of them is Lotus and the Meteors. You know, one of them is Lotus and Loss, Lotus and Booze, whatever it is. So I was with a couple friends, my best friends, actually, and I'm actually at my best friend's house right now doing this interview. But okay. Anyway, I was at his apartment, and it was kind of late, you know, and I had this idea, and I was like, man, what if we got a temporary tattoo ink, and we inked all the names from all the titles from this book all over me, you know, and made this like this art thing, you know. And he was like, fuck yeah, let's do it. So we went out and bought this this temporary tattoo ink pen and went back and had a couple beers and just had fun with it, you know. he drew all these little drawings. His name's Matt. He drew all these little drawings on my body as well, like a lotus flower and stuff like that. So I thought it turned out really cool.
Well, it looked very cool. You know, at first when I saw it, I thought, how did he do that by himself?
Right.
Because you'd have to be in a mirror and everything would be backwards. And then I thought, somebody else did that. There's no way he could do that. Well, it was also funny because it was reminiscent of my days at your age. But we used to do it a little bit differently. We used to wait till somebody got drunk and passed out and then draw on them. So when they woke up,
They'd have.
And it was never anything very nice. It was
this was voluntary drawing, you know. Yeah, this was planned, you know, and we had a really, really fun time with it. I think we played some video games and, you know, wrote all these titles over my body, had some beers. It was a good time. And I really like the idea of writing all these titles, because some of these titles might be uncomfortable, you know, and that's part of the journey with Lotus and the Apocalypse, was writing this thing that forced me to be really vulnerable about, you know, maybe my faults or the parts of myself that I don't talk about or that you might be a little ashamed of, or the things in your past that you're guilty for, whatever it is, you know. It's putting that all out to the world, you know, and that I kind of saw, you know, writing those titles on my skin as a metaphor for that, a representation of that, you know, just letting it all out there and being honest in every possible definition of the word.
Well, that's great. So this is your new book?
Yep. Yeah. It's called Lotus and the Apocalypse, and it's coming out from Outcast Press on March 1st. And it's different from my past projects, because it's a poetry novella. So instead of chapters, each chapter is written in verse, in poetry, and each poem, you know, leads into the next, and it tells this narrative, this story about the last day on Earth for this character named Lotus as they, you know, meditate on their past and relationships, love, connections, family, you know, loss, drug abuse, and mental health and mental illness are, you know, the forefront of this project. And the whole idea is you try to work your way through these internal issues and external issues to try to save your life, I guess.
Well, that's interesting. So it's written in poetic verse, but it tells a whole story, in other words.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like a collection of unrelated work.
Oh, no, yeah. So
yeah.
Each, yeah, each poem leads into the next, and each title of the poem actually is Lotus and blank. So it, you know, I wanted Lotus, this character Lotus, to be the, you know, a really central part of the story. So I wanted each poem to be a different either internal or external issue that this character is working their way through.
Well, I'm anxious to check it out. You said March 1st?
Yeah, yeah. March 1st is when it comes out. Actually, my box of books is supposed to arrive tomorrow from my publisher, so I'm really pumped to hold the book in my hands. You know, and for me, poetry, it's definitely therapeutic, but it's also a way to try to connect with people between, you know, across space and time. You know, I think one thing that really drew me to art and literature when I was young was the idea that you could create this thing that lives on past yourself, and this thing that people halfway across the world could experience, you know, and it's really just putting your own experiences into this form that other people can, you know, use to work their way through their own problems, you know, and I think that that's magic in a way.
Well, that's what I've always admired about creative artists, is because you leave your mark on planet Earth, regardless of what it is. If it's a film you made, a book you wrote,
yeah,
a song you sang and recorded, you know, the shows that I've been doing for the last 5 or 6, well, how long have I been doing it now? 7 years? 7 on the audio podcast and starting second year on the video show. But, you know, hopefully they'll still be there when I'm gone.
Right, and that's awesome. You know, it's like you created this thing that, you know, maybe after we're bones in a grave, you know, someone can still listen to this conversation, you know, and I think that's really awesome. That's so, it's complicated, but it's amazingly beautiful.
Yeah, I've already decided I don't want to be buried. I want to be cremated. So I'll be I'll be dust in the wind.
There you go.
Instead of bones in a box. All right. Well, Austin, let's wrap this up. Give out your website. Do you have a website?
Yeah, the one that I've been using is actually through this. It's a domain called Milkshake, and it's just Milkshake/Austin Davis. It's in my bio on Instagram, and if you Google Austin Davis, you'll probably find it. You know,
all right.
But it's got, you know, all my recent interviews, poems, news articles, all sorts of fun stuff, and the book comes out March 1st, and then I'm going on a national tour, which is going to be really, really fucking cool. I'm really excited about that.
Oh, well, great. And, you know, COVID's winding down, so that shouldn't be an issue
at this point. Hopefully, yeah. You know, it feels like it's going up and down in waves. And, it, you know, I don't know about you, but it's felt like a really long 2 years.
Oh, God, yes. Well, most of the states, I saw a map, and there's only like 3 or 4 states that still have any kind of mask mandates. Some states are just putting masks on kids, but not for everyone else. But I think most of the country is 75%. You still have to wear them on the plane for now.
Right.
But, you know, shopping malls and things and meetings and indoor events, most places, it's not a problem. You don't have to mask anymore. You can if you want, but they're not going to force you to. So.
You know, what's heartbreaking to me is just like the way that I feel like death has become so normalized over the last couple of years with the pandemic. You know, we see all these numbers about how many people are dying in our state or our community or our country or whatever. And it, you know, I feel like it doesn't even faze us anymore in a way, even though, you know, for a lot of us, we've probably had family members die, or we've had people that we've known or people that we know who have known people who have died or been seriously ill, you know, and it's devastating to think that, you know, this all, in a way, some of it could have been avoided if we just quarantined in the beginning and social distanced and wore masks and got vaccinated and did that as a collective, you know, instead of person by person, you know.
Well, it's true. Although there's two sides to every topic. And
right.
Let me break this down a little, because it's a kind of a multi-part thing. When you're talking about trivializing or normalizing death, we are actually, believe it or not, we are actually far more sensitive to death these days, because the media brings it right to our phone instantly. Okay.
Yeah.
And back in the old days, when people were dying by the thousands of typhoid and cholera and smallpox and all of these diseases, death was much more of a reality for people. You know, you go back 150 years, people were dropping dead all over the place.
Right,
and it was just the fact of life, right? People just dealt with it and got on. People also didn't live as long back then. Average life expectancies was like in 50s, 60 years old, right?
Now, the beauties of modern medicine, you know?
Yeah, now most of us are going to, as long as we take care of ourselves, we can expect to live in the Western world anyways. We can expect to live into our 80s. And if you go to other countries in the world, they're still suffering from things that we don't have to suffer with, like unclean drinking water.
Oh, 100%.
Right? There's all kinds of... So the problem with the COVID situation is that... And I blame the media. See, there was just a lot of hype about it because it's new. All right? People die of the flu every year, and you don't hear about it. because it happens every year. People understand it. They get their flu shot or not. And if they have comorbidities, then their doctor might tell them to get the flu shot or not to get the flu shot. But the media hype this thing so much that when you start tuning in every day on the news to see the death numbers, I think it's pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that just, I think it's sort of irresponsible. There is a point to where information can be used for the benefit of society and information can be used for the manipulation of society. And I think there's a fine line there. And I think it's the media outlet's responsibility to make the distinction. Unfortunately, they don't, because it sells newspapers and it sells video and it sells, you know, clicks and likes and ratings. And it's something that I try to fight against on my show. I like to offer people all different opinions and let them figure it out for themselves, not just hand them an opinion. But I agree in the sense that we could have done better. We could always have done better.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the...
But this is a new...
Is the avoidability.
Yeah, but this was also, you know, in defense of the media and the CDC and those people, in defense of them, this was a brand new thing. We've never had...
Yeah, I mean, we didn't know anything about it. You know, and I think that there's a huge distinction between COVID and the flu, you know, because if you look at, you know, how many people have died from it or have suffered from it, and, you know, there's long COVID, we don't even know the long-term effects of having had COVID, you know, and
no,
it's, we still don't know all there is to know about this virus. I'm, you know, fully vaccinated and boosted. And I think I feel grateful that I've had the opportunity to do so, you know, because I remember, you know, actually it's funny. One of the first poem in Lotus and the Apocalypse, I wrote it when I first thought I had contracted COVID, and it was very early on. I think it was either March or April of 2020. And I was living with my parents who were older, and that coupled with the anxiety of, oh my God, am I going to, you know, kill these people I love without ever meaning to do so, actually inspired me to write this poem, which threw me into writing this book about the end of the world, you know. But it's been a scary couple of years for the whole world, I think, you know. And I think there's this trauma as well that hasn't been talked about a lot from...
Yeah, I think there's definitely going to be emotional damage done from this. And I think especially to the kids who had to stay home for a year. And not that I'm saying that, I don't want to get into this whole issue of online learning. But that is hard for them. And it was hard for the parents, because the parents were used to having the kids away for that day.
Yeah.
Now that somebody had to stay home, they had to either quit their job or change their job. And it was a big disruption to people's normal routine.
Oh, I completely agree. My parents actually, I have a younger brother who's 16 and a sister who is 12. And they went all online and they had to stay home. And, you know, I remember, I think it was for my parents, it was like having another job of helping them get through online school, because it's like, you know, it's like having to teach yourself in some aspects, you know.
Yeah.
I've been doing online school for the last couple of years, because of the pandemic, but also now, just because it allows me the freedom to learn on my time and, you know, do homeless outreach during the day, go on tour, write this book. And it for me, it gives me more freedom. But, you know, for a kid, I feel like that would be really disruptive, you know, not just for the educational aspect, but also, yeah, for the emotional aspect, not being able to see your friends.
Well, exactly.
Every day, you know, that sounds really tough as well. Everything about the pandemic's been tough, I think.
The socialization is what's important for children. I'm all for adults and online education. I think it's brilliant. They didn't have it back when I was at the age that I could have done it. But I think that when I saw that was starting out, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. But not for the kids. You know, when you're at university level, it's great. But for the kids need to socialize. They need to be with their friends. They need physical things.
Yeah.
They need exercise. They need to play with their friends. Sports activities, all of the different things that come with in-person schools, not just sitting in a classroom. learning about, you know, math and history. You need all of that.
You know, and honestly, that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, is because I think we've all, over the last couple of years, in some way, at some point, felt this loneliness, you know, or this isolation, or, whatever it is. On, for me at least, on a different scale, a more complicated, a confusing, you know, a more confusing loneliness, you know. And that's one of my huge goals with my poetry, you know, is to make these connections and to show people that are feeling what I've felt, you know, that they're not alone, and that, you know, they can get better, and there is help, and there are people out there that care about them. You know, kind of just circling back to the infinite beauty of art, I think that the idea that maybe someone could read one of these poems in 50 years and be going through something very similar and feel this hug between time and space is just, it's mind-blowingly incredible to me.
Certainly is. On that note, we got to wrap it up. My guest is Austin Davis. Your new book is called Lotus and the Apocalypse. You said it's coming out March 1st, right?
March 1st, yep.
Okay, super. Well, best of luck with the book. Nice talking to you again. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Douglas. It's always great catching up with you, man.
We said to them,